Last time we started to explore how your conceptual map affects your reasoning. This time we talk about the value of actually choosing one that lines up with reality. And we had fun. But if I understood the why behind a structure, if I understood the why behind a company selection, if I understood the why behind riders or how it was built, the outcome of that is there's going to be a higher probability of success in light of, in face of, knowing full well that the future is unknown. I mean, that's what I've come to learn, and it seems simple to me.
Oh, that's great. And with the people I've talked to, I mean, it's not uncommon for people to come with policies they got from other agents, and we do a standard review, like in-force policy review, where I kind of tell them what they have.
Yeah.
For the first time.
Right. You know? Might not be exactly what they understood they were purchasing.
It's usually not. I mean, there are some similarities, you know.
Yeah.
Some points that are resolved for. But yeah, so what the next layer of this, I think, and we can keep going in as many layers as you want, but without like explicit without explicit reference or explicit regard to like what the individual is trying to do with their purposes with becoming their own banker, and if we don't trace out how those specific, hopefully very nicely refined, articulated goals, if we don't trace out how that affects and shapes the policy design, if we don't do that, well then if that's not there, what else is, right? And that's kind of what I'm saying, is that without that purpose-filled driving structure, you create a vacuum. And in that vacuum, it's just a matter of, and everyone's got a different threshold, right? How much do I need to hear? How much like bedazzlement is it going to take for me to finally say yes? Like, and I think the nature of a lot of what we see online is happening in that context. And the report.
That's the only way it can thrive in the context.
Yes. It creeps in when you have no explicit intentional recourse to like purposeful argument. And it's very tempting. This is the other element of this kind of postmodern spirit of modernity, frankly, is that it is so tempting, right? It's so easy to run the numbers, you know, just look at the page and
send me an illustration.
Yeah. The slower conceptual deduction is actually more difficult, and it just takes long, and you can't see it on the page. You can see the words on the page, you can read the words, but then you got to reason through the meaning, and that's harder. Whereas on the page, it's just, you can see the, and that's why people make fun. And I know the clients who call, who's like, it's like, yeah, I could tell them the difference between the size of two numbers. I know people make fun of, but it's like a cliche or a slogan for a reason. Like that's been the coup. The educational coup on Wall Street is to convince people that financial analysis means to find the bigger number.
Yeah. And I don't think that, you know, you can say it's a cliche, it's pithy, you know, it sounds good. And, you know, there's a lot of, I call them drive-by innuendos, which that is not right. And I would think, And of course, I'm closer than maybe, and I hear more from you directly, but that is not given as a way to avoid an argument, right? Some contrite drive-by, you know, innuendo that I want to throw out there, because I can't defend my position if you're going to oppose it. You know, I can't maybe articulate my position. So I would rather just throw something out there to avoid a debate or reasoning.
Yeah. Right?
Compared to some of the others that, you know, that everybody latches on to, is like banking is a process, not a product. Of course. Well, what all are you going to stuff behind there? Right. To avoid defending or promoting your position or conveying confidently your position.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's just one example. There are many. And I think another difference is if you say bigger number, better, sooner, sounds very simplistic, but that would cue me, I would think, and most people to wonder why you said that, you know, and then maybe listen to the particular podcast or if you've done writing on it, you know, of why.
Of why.
Why did you say that?
And I think some people do that and then they maybe are not so happy when they feel like they can't find the answer. And there are other people who maybe don't do too much of that.
Right. Yeah. No question.
Yeah.
But I'm just pointing out a distinct difference in pithy type comments.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. And here's another advantage of going into like thinking about the character of patterns of behavior and the character and form of like of arguments is it really it helps you spot prepackaged
what?
Ideas in the wild.
What? Going on in the vacuum?
If you kind of have an idea of like what the broader intellectual undercurrents of the day are, then there are typically sort of packaged ideas that kind of go together that are in a given current of thought. And so somebody who might encounter one of those who's not aware of the deeper cultural context might think that, oh, they just discovered something new out of whole cloth. Like, oh my gosh, let's just look what we can do with an illustration, you know? Whereas if you take the approach of like, yeah, this is nothing new, like the debate that you can supplant rational deductive thought and reasoning with looking at numbers on a page, that is not new at all. Like that is all of what economists have been doing for 80 years.
I got to read the book and an article on economics, and that was not my favorite subject in school.
I know. Yeah.
You know, I've got to read that. And you're talking about a transcript of Senate hearings? Are you crazy? I just need a bigger number, sir, and I need it sooner. And I'm just saying that.
Well, there's the right, and that's why I tell people, I'm like, we can go as deep as you want.
Yeah.
How, you know, and I'd like to go deeper in certain areas that I'm not prepared to, like the on the actuarial side. I mean, I'd love to have the time to go through actuarial mathematical programs and learn their particular number crunching so that I could come back and explain it in words.
Did we talk about... you know, I don't want to derail you. Yeah. I promise I don't. But did we talk about previously on an episode of some of your interactions with life insurance companies?
We have, yeah.
We have?
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
Like what? Like my conversations with product designers and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. If I'm any part of the conversation, you know, sometimes I am. I give them a fair encouragement. You better sharpen your pencil. You better know your products and why your products and offerings exist before you talk to Mr. Griggs. He might read up on your own actuarial data and background. And they, you know, I don't know how they take it. They thank me, of course. And, oh, okay, yeah. I'm like, and then they talk to Mr. Griggs and I can only imagine what they look like out of the outcome. It's like, my God, I'm glad to get off that call. They look beat up after three rounds with a heavyweight. I don't know, you know.
Well, I mean, it's like to find
the. And my point there is deep. He wants to go deep, like you said earlier, and find the rock bottom. You know, by golly, he wants to find it. And God bless you.
Well, thank you. I do think it's helpful, you know, to get a sense of why things are for people who are interested in that.
Listen, if I'm going to work with somebody. I don't want to read all that. Maybe, you know, I'm good with reading this and the first works, but, you know, and that's enough for me, right? I'm okay with that.
Right.
But I want to work with somebody who's gone to the rock bottom. I personally want to work with, and I don't use the term very often, an expert, you know, a craftsman, somebody who's knowledgeable, experienced, and, you know, above, on the higher end. Of quality.
I would think you'd want to take advantage of specialization in the division of labor.
No question.
Put it in economic terms.
Well, you're the economist. I speak plain English, sir.
I mean, I'm not going to medical school, you know, figure out how to take care of a heart surgery if I would need one. Or
would you walk into your cardiologist, and you don't have one, and self-diagnose? Would you write your own prescription?
Yeah, well, we could maybe. Of course not.
Would you write out your own treatment plan?
No.
I'm not saying you wouldn't modify it with natural, whatever you do as an individual.
This actually gets to a good point because I've thought some about this too. It's like, obviously an agent isn't a cardiologist. And it's like, obviously there's this difference in trade-offs between the type of reasons you might come to see a cardiologist versus a life insurance agent. But
you know, and I'm not trying to, you know, bring up physicians
right.
to elevate. No, it's like, but we were talking about your money, so it may be of vital interest.
Yeah. And look, we're not going to, it's kind of silly, the idea of elevating ourselves to the status of a physician. It's like, I'm just going to go the other way around.
I'm throwing that out there, you know, it's like, there's reasons I'm throwing, there's a why behind all that.
Yeah, but the more technical thing is there's a division of labor, and so you should want a specialist, I would think. And in an agent advisory capacity, this gets, like, to me, this discussion we're having now affects what it means to be a quote-unquote advisor.
Oh.
Rather than just an agent, right? An agent is just the legal status of somebody who sells products for a life insurance company. An agent of the company, you're selling their stuff. An advisor, that is a different thing, just conceptually, technically. And what, to me, it's like, why would someone select a given advisor if agents are just agents? You know, why one instead of the other? And I think what matters there is a perspective and competence, like a unique, hopefully well-anchored perspective that sheds light and is true, like is actually
a and not just a narrow opinion. I mean, we all have opinions. We all come with our previous influences. But in an advisory role, it's not down to here's my only opinion. Right, so narrowed of a presentation of advice or consultation.
That's a great contrast. Like having a perspective versus just rinsing and repeating the same mechanistic, just cookie cutter type thing.
Yes.
It's a real difference.
True.
And when I have and the clients who maybe they wouldn't use those words, but they, in so many words, understand that, and the conversations we have are much more vibrant and, you know,
pleasant.
Pleasant certainly, but the spectrum.
I mean,
they're
all pleasant.
The spectrum of things we cover and like they're not new in the sense, but they are in some sense revealed, like discovered in conversation.
Absolutely,
of how to properly or how to beneficially think of this or that decision, or how to properly or beneficially or optimally is the right word, how to optimally accept given financial circumstances, you know, to get accumulated savings and some unusual ongoing cash flow most efficiently into a policy over time, like to do all of that, the layers and the vibrancy that comes out of that. That's where the real magic happens.
I completely agree with that and live that on a daily basis, right? Oh. I would hope that the listener to this Banking with Life podcast, all of these episodes, I would hope and I believe at some level, more often than not, there is a level of discovery through the nuance, through the detail, through the depth, that is not generally easily found elsewhere. You know,
right.
It's completely away from the analytical, you know, number crunching mass that exists. So I would hope very much that this podcast helps the listener along their process of discovery.
Yeah. And if you do try to go deeper into like the conventional sources, I tell you what, you're not going to find much there. You're not going to have that revelatory, like, it kind of feels like you're take, you know, peeling back the layers and, you know, seeing things more and more clearly as you go. That doesn't happen in the convention. And how could it? Because in the conventional setting, everything is built on fractional reserve banking and the unpredictable fact of the business cycle. And there's no attempt to address that. There's no attempt to address
what?
The problem of those periodic collapses in value.
There's nothing wrong with our banking system. It's stable.
Yeah. So what could be there, right? There's nothing, there is no, there isn't a way to like expertly, and of course, all the people have their like little approaches that seem to have happened over some carefully crafted timeline and some carefully observed index and for some particular part of a business cycle, and all of those things may be coincidentally interesting, and you could find like, oh, so and so made returns over, you know, period X to Y that just so happened to line up with some explosion in the money supply. It's like
coincidentally it like makes for a great presentation.
Yeah,
how convenient.
But there's nothing special to be attributed to some to the judgment of somebody who happened to float along with the business cycle. It's like that's not, you don't get bonus points for happening to be on the boat when the tide went up, you know?
What?
It's like you're not the special captain, you know, that something else was responsible for that. And that's the business cycle, and which at the end of the day can be traced to the decision makers of commercial banks and the Federal Reserve Board, which isn't you and me.
And there's a why behind all those decisions.
Sure. I mean, and if you like history and want to get into that, you can spend a lot of time. But at the end of the day, there's nothing there to unravel other than the disappointing failed careers of past economists. You know.
Struck a nerve there.
Well, whereas with IBC, it is. It's like, every, you know, you come to a new layer. It's like, how could that be possible? Wait, it's all guaranteed. Wait, it's all private. Wait, it's all post-tax. Wait, it's all tax deferred. Wait, I can get to it all tax-free. Wait, I don't have to pay it back if I don't want to. If I do, I can do it when I want. Like it's layer upon layer of like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And it feels like people describe it as, you know, you're falling, or it's like the paradigm shift. I mean, we all have these different ways of explaining what that feels like, but I think what's responsible for that feeling is the fact that it's just connected to deeper analytical and like conceptual truths. And it conforms. It conforms to the structure of human existence, right? Like it lines up with what people need, which is, as it so happens, more and more capital. So like if you accept that initial presupposition of like it's a good thing to have more capital, well then there's a whole track to fall down here.
No question.
That lines up very nicely with, if anybody's interested, the kinds of things that people have talked about, you know, in the history of Austrian economics.
So
which to me should be exciting. It's like there's a personal financial thing I can do that I don't have to participate in any of the crap that is legitimately linked to formal published ideas. Yeah, there's more work to be done there, of course, because this thing is, you know, regarded as untraditional or contrarian or whatever. Okay, fine. That's all an opportunity. But there's something here, right? There's something there. There's substance. Whereas I think if you look at conventional, you go poke a conventional financial advisor and ask them what the core of their intellectual superstructure is, you know, who are they reading? What major economists from whenever, let them choose when, that they're relying on, and see if they can go past like a Eugene Fama or a Harry Markowitz. They're not going to. They're going to pull up stuff about pricing securities under neoclassical, made up, purposefully unrealistic assumptions, and then they'll talk to you about how they can put that in a computer, and then they'll talk to you about how some of them ran hedge funds into the dirt.
Timelines.
Oh, cherry picked. Yeah, then they all went and crashed Lehman Brothers. It's like, you can't make this up. But that's at the core of the conventional financial framework, and yet we, as proponents of whole life, have to hear that whole life is the worst place to put money, and then Dave Ramsey, the types on the pop folks, go on the radio programs and get the millions. I'm not bitter. Maybe I am. I don't know. But get all the attention for repeating poorly laundered ideas from a very young, by the way, very young intellectual tradition with a pretty bad track record.
I wonder why. Yeah.
And then people wonder why, you know, the state of personal finance, people don't have savings and you know, they're beholden to lenders and everybody wants to go find the next, you know, special hack it thing. I mean, we're so disoriented, literally, economically and financially. It's kind of bewildering.
It's really heartbreaking in some cases.
I mean, yeah. You over get into and the over. Specifics of like individual situations. It's really sad.
33 years. I'm just, you know, not always, but there's a lot of it. So, you know, it's alternative. The banking cycle, the boom bust cycle, the economic cycle, the Austrian business cycle is left out of economics. Fractional reserve banking is like a third rail. You can't really talk about that and be successful or remain platformed. And then the banking function at the you and me level, you mean it's possible? So it's well beyond just a place, a great place to put money, build capital. Wait, I got to have capital or access to capital to perform the banking function? I didn't even know I could control the banking function. And I sure as heck have never been told what it could potentially mean to me and my family and my future legacy.
Yeah.
If I were to even practice that control, gain some control, never even knew that existed, right? And so how there's no way that this couldn't be alternative, could not be alternative.
Right.
I mean, so And then you're the tinfoil hat wearer and you know, whomever's talking about the infinite banking concept, you know, their integrity is challenged or whatever because, you know, it's just a sales gimmick. You're just selling life insurance.
Yeah. Or making mountains out of molehills or getting all worked up for no reason.
Yeah. Right. Majoring in the minors.
Majoring
in the minors.
The example that comes to mind is like if you just imagine that the way that this is a hypothetical, but imagine that the way everybody gets their haircut, it's a buzz cut. Everybody. That's just what everybody's always done. We just all get buzz cuts. And here comes along a barber that says, you know, you can have whatever style you want. And people are like,
what?
What? That's not how we do things. That's not what I heard. Shorter, faster, sooner, better, right? Like it's just, isn't the speed all that matters? Like, isn't the efficiency all that?
Yeah, and then I'm going to get real analytical after you get your new style that you chose that you didn't know you could choose. And then I'm going to come right behind that and I'm going to show you how to make that better.
Right.
Right.
Look, it could be shorter. Everybody else is doing this, you know? Yeah.
I developed a new blade to go on the clippers, you know? It's faster. The motor's faster. I can enhance that. Yeah. You know.
Rothbard used to use the example of like to explain what happens when the government takes over something. He's like, imagine if the government produced shoes. You know, there'd be one type, one color, one size, and not enough of them. <You know? laughs> And if that's how people just had shoes, and then here comes along somebody saying, oh, but you know, you can have whatever color you want. We'll make you a size that fits you and that you might like. It'd be like,
give me some choices of different styles.
What? It's like, yeah, you know.
Nelson. No, I want to be just like him. In him, in him, in him, in him, in him.
Yeah. Nelson, so, the fish are the last to notice the water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, I don't have to, you know, I can have the same dividend regardless of whether or not I have a loan outstanding.
What? I'm in an environment and my money is in an environment. And if I'm in this environment and I discover that I'm in this environment, then maybe that'll inform my actions, which may be different from yours. And one of the thought processes maybe means that if your money is in an environment, and it is, and you recognize the environment that it is, oh, it's a little process of discovery, and then discover that what? I can control the environment in which I operate my money
by contract.
Oh my gosh. And I have all these other beneficial characteristics. but you're going to describe that using a word that has been demonized and browbeaten and a product that has been browbeaten and demonized and to prevent me, maybe, I don't know, there is a why, I don't know that that is a why, but I'm just throwing it out there as a possibility to prevent me to even discover that I could control the environment. Hell, I didn't even know my money even operated in an environment. The mere fact that I could control it and consider a comparative outcome to the norm, it's like, that's absolutely a discovery. Oh, and then if we go down that road and, you know, the more we discover and comparison, and then we can start properly classifying things. Oh, my gosh.
Proper classification.
Oh, my gosh.
Funny how this lines up with what Nelson Nash wrote, huh?
Yeah, I'm shocked. You didn't create anything new to supersize it or to a bolt on. I've heard that. So, you know, you got a bolt on.
Yeah, whatever the way to make it better is.
No. Yeah, whatever new terminology. Yeah.
But it's economics. So you got to roll the eyes. I mean, Nelson would tell people enthusiastically that he was a. Personally mentored by Leonard Reed for 42 years.
What?
He was very proud of the fact that what he thought aligned with what he understood from his economics education. And he regarded it as like, in so many words, I'm saying this, as like an opportunity like to explain this material, what we're doing in economic terms. Like the guy, the one who came up with it, thought that. Like maybe there's something to that, right? Like, maybe it's not something to be avoided or shunned. There's something there again. And I just think it's, for me, as you know, coming from that economic background and, you know, whatever it was, problems with authority, you know.
You say that in the past tense.
Right. Ongoing, current, established, routine, repeated problems with authority. But to be able to hitch my financial approach to a real intellectual tradition, both in terms of just the economics, but then deeper, like the nature of science, like the nature of just deep inquiry into how things are, right? To know to some degree, to some level, that what I'm doing with my own money here today, 2024, is linked with, carries a relation, follows in line and a tradition like that, to me, is I really like that.
Yeah, well, you...
It's a source of optimism for me. You know?
Absolutely.
It's
like, you vetted the traditions, the economic traditions.
Yeah.
Before your discovery here.
Right.
And... that was a real, process of discovery for a young man studying economics, degreed in economics, and particular economics, you know, deciding, you know, what your preference was and why, going down to the rock bottom of the why, you know, he can argue with an economist from whatever school successfully. And then to see this, you know, discover this, become exposed to this, and then the alignment, like you said, I mean, that's pretty powerful. Yeah. And I think at some level, we all do that. You know, it happened to me, you know, 14 years in the life insurance business and trying to do the right thing, doing the right thing. I wasn't trying to do. In my mind, I was doing the right thing for my clients, myself, my family, the greater public, and still am. Not that I'm perfect, but to meet Nelson Nash 14 years later, while I'm looking for the truth about economics, money, not in a formal academic way, more informal, and looking at what I had done previously, what I had learned, I'm still a student, right? And then finding this, it was, you know, nirvana. I mean, but it was such a paradigm shift in thinking that we all go through that at some point, you know, but your experience is real to you and, of course, and you know, effective and informative and changing at different levels. And I'm just saying that we all go through that, you know, at some level. And some of us just get it. That makes sense to me. I understand the why and the reasoning, and I get it, and I'm ready to go. Others, you know, they're a different timeline of understanding, acceptance, or rejection of this idea, this concept. And then they want to get deeper into it, you know. But I love the individual stories and experiences of people and clients. It's just powerful to me.
There's a anybody who is interested in the history of intellectual thought will know the name Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N. And he is what brought this up is the term paradigm shift. He has a book. I think it's The Nature. I might be thinking of the Nature and Origin of the Wealth of Nations. I might be thinking of Adam Smith. But Thomas Kuhn has a book on paradigm shifts, on how scientific intellectual paradigms change over time. And it's a well-known, oft-cited type book. But that idea, there's not a lot of writing on the role of ideology and how ideas affect actions and what that means for economic metrics or whatever. But there's some, and Kuhn's one of them. And there's an allure to this idea of like, okay, what is a paradigm shift? You know, what do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Does he bring that out in this book?
Yeah.
Is that a result
I'll tell you it's easily found here. Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Thank you, Google. The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And he just explains the name, but this more broadly, the idea of a paradigm, you know, how does that happen? How does a scientific revolution occur? You know, what's the structure of them? Has always been an interesting intellectual domain of, and no one really has a good answer is my point, right? Is that no one really knows how to explain it well, but like using, I think, Jordan Peterson's map metaphor, like our way of thinking, our framework is a map, you know, it tells us. I think a paradigm shift is like that, the moment that it happens where the light bulb goes off or the switch flips or whatever the analogy is we want to use. I think that's basically like the moment of discovering that a different map is actually better for the territory. And the one that you were using, that you were relying on, there's a moment of discovery of inadequacy. And when that old map, that old way, that old framework, that old way of establishing the necessary context for the manifestation of meaning, when that changes and there's a flash of an observation that the new map is in fact more aligned with underlying objective reality, I think that's a paradigm shift where the new intellectual framework supplanted.
I appreciate that, and I was unaware of that book, but you know, you're then pointing or putting that a point of discovery in a finite place, right?
I'm just saying it happens. I'm just saying there it happens at an acute moment in time.
Okay, an acute moment in time. So it's a finite place, right? An acute moment in time.
What do you mean by a place? I'm not referring to actual maps, actual physical locations.
No, I understand that, but just the process. I think the discovery process to the point where it changes your map, your future actions. I think that is a process.
Well, there's a moment
before that.
There's
epiphany
or
acute moment of realization, of discovery of a different map.
I think there's two margins. That the map itself has changed, that's one margin.
Yeah.
The second one is the degree of clarity of whatever map it is you're on.
Yeah.
And so the process of ongoing improvement in the resolution of increasing clarity, I think that is just an ongoing process regardless of whatever map you're using.
Absolutely.
But the recognition, the moment
that
of
moment. Okay.
The map, a different map would be better, even though I don't have as great, in fact, I may not even have great resolution on the new map. In fact, one of the reasons I might like it is because I've developed a greater degree of resolution on the map I already have.
Yes.
And have discovered that it's crap.
Yes, I love to hear that And I love both sides, hearing both parts, right? Yeah. Or both. I really like the whole timeline, the two margins. That first margin is, I talked to a lot of people, but just the seemingly disconnected events or experiences that trigger the desire and the actual decision to continue down this new discovery, a new path of discovering something different. And I think those are wrought with epiphanies, and multiple moments of time that a small paradigm shift in thinking, just recognizing that I might be in my current map, maybe, some part of a construct that I didn't realize before.
Right.
So that's enough of an epiphany or an acute moment in time to, like, I may be onto something.
Yeah.
You know? And then, of course, you could have another discovery that this idea, this concept, this knowledge is whack, which is another epiphany.
Yeah.
So you keep going a different way.
Those epiphanies, I think, it's like moments of new awareness, of observation of either the disjoint or the integration between the map and reality.
Yeah.
Like, how closely are those? Yeah. And the revelation of the degree of closeness, I think, is like I get it.
Yeah. Those are very, when the individual shares with me, I just love that.
Yeah.
I love
hearing the voice.
Their experience. What caused that? Why were you even thinking that way? Mm-hmm. I filed bankruptcy. They didn't file bankruptcy. They were thinking one thing was true. I'm looking at this over here. And while I'm looking at that, there was something mentioned, referenced, or, became apparent to me. Maybe it was the first time I even recognized it. And then the rabbit trail, continues. I just like them. I love them because at the you and me level, it's your experience. I ask everyone, how did you become exposed to this? I want to hear that.
Very same.
Huh?
Every person. I want to know, what's the background? How'd you come? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very. I just love it, and I learn from it, and sometimes it reinforces my predetermined biases, and sometimes I learn, and I mostly learn.
I think that map, the idea of cohesion between your sort of intellectual cognitive map and actual reality, I think it has a lot of explanatory power. Like, as a customer, as a client, part of why we use different sources of specialized labor is to help develop an understanding of elements of the map that we don't have our own personal understanding to do. And if that's not met, like if that's not happening in a conversation with an advisor, with a specialist, whatever the domain is, finance, IBC, whatever, if that's not happening, I think the discomfort that one feels in that comes from that the failure to specify and articulate a map for that region, for that domain of whatever it is, in a manner that accords with reality. For whatever reason, that's not happening. And that failure creates the discomfort, the frustration, the sort of that lack of what's going on here. I don't get it. Like, that comes from that lack of coherence between what we're mapping out and actual reality in a given domain. And some people, and this is what I really don't like, allow themselves to be, I know that's not, no one allows themselves to be bullied, but they accept that their own ignorance and outsource judgment with respect to whatever it is that's causing them frustration or lack of understanding. They outsource it to the media personality who is manufacturing a certain persona. A certain air of sophistication, right? A certain, for that purpose, right?
Yes,
to leverage authority in place of clarifying explanation about the way things are.
Have you, right? When you use the terms, the leveraging authority, have you been talking to, you know, social media services? I'm just asking.
Not willingly. I mean, any of that, I get it. It's like a, you know, drive-by click funnel marketing. Like, oh, can't get it off. You know, you're just scrolling through. Like,
it's so constructed. Yeah. So much of what we see and read is so constructed.
Yeah. But you can see how, to somebody who may, like me, kind of sees things in this, in the way we've been talking about for the last 90 minutes, that would be frustrating.
Yes.
Like, to see the supposition of authority and just instruction and dictation of, listen, do this, on the basis of fundamentally invalid scientific non-argument, no less, like, to make things worse, right? So we have the air of authority, and then we have poor underlying reasoning, or poor inappropriate structure to the underlying reasoning, to the extent there is any. And then there's a decision that's going to come out of that. And then those people are the ones saying that I'm the commission hound. You know, it's like, guys, how many layers of this really is there? You know, it's like, this is getting silly.
It's been silly.
It's been silly. Anyway, no, I think it's, yeah, there's so much here, you know, for people who want to fall all the way down the rabbit hole. There's a whole rabbit colony down there. Like, come on, you know,
and more than one.
Yeah. But that's what I'm going to talk about. And so, I know where I was going with that is for people today watching, whenever you're watching, like, it's okay to want to have a good map. It's okay to want to feel confident that, you know, the GPS is going to take you to where you're trying to go. Right? You wouldn't just
go in the right direction. Can we just start there?
You can start there. But look, to start in the right direction, even then, supposes that you can orient yourself.
Yes.
And in order to do that, you've got to have you got to be motivated by certain purposes, because it's always a question of whether the proposed solution is going to align or meet what the initial purpose is. It's the compatibility between means and ends. But that always has to be, the reference always has to be the initial individual's purpose, not look at the big number on the page. Any sort of computational, mathematical calculation, that should all be in service to a broader, deeper, predominant, motivating reason, right? That should be subservient. That is the quintessential feature of, like, the modern era of inversion, right? Yeah. Is the cart before the horse. It's technique before purpose. It's, you know, computation before morality, right? That's the... surprise, I don't know if you've seen the news, like, looked around, that's what the culture is, right? The era of inversion. That's why clown world, all that we see. It's the same thing. The same thing goes on in the marketing or quote-unquote education around certain financial topics or products. It's the same deal. And so when people say that Nelson Nash stands in contrast, that he's bottom up, right, it's like somebody who went and traversed the territory himself and came back and reported what he saw, and that's the basis of his map, right? And then we can start to reason more about that and hopefully come away with something that actually comports with reality, which I think happens, which is why the kind of business that comes out of this approach is, in technical terms, extremely persistent, right? It stays in force, which is why the result of the type of product and the form that comes out of the alternative approach of this scientific approach is relatively impersistent. People throw away the maps relatively more often than in the sort of Nelson Nash type approach.
I wonder why that matters.
Because it doesn't comport with what their expectations were. So yeah, why does that matter? Of course, it's going to matter. Just as you say.
No question. Yeah, I got to start over. I got to get mad and quit, burn it down, start over. And how many times do you want to do that throughout your life?
Yeah, I'm working with a older parents of an adult client right now, and, you know, it's kind of the task of, let's get what we can, let's do what we can, you know, starting this late with the universal life policy that's cannibalizing itself.
What?
Which it was designed to do. And
they just didn't pay enough premium.
You know, now
the,
it's now
the advisor just didn't design it properly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But the conversation we're having now is how do we get something in force to help with, you know, to do something as opposed to how much can we do? Right. Like what?
Yeah.
How like, great could this be?
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, but that's the result of, again, this is nothing new. That's the result of the default, unintentional. I'm not saying like nobody wakes up and decides that they're going to go adopt the, you know, unfavorable ways of thinking about finance, but just being unconsciously in a certain inherited paradigm.
They're following a map.
That's the result. They're following a map.
Presented, yeah. Encouraged, reinforced.
You can change the map. Hello, you can change the map. Throw the old one out. Just come get a new one. It's very nice. It's peaceful. Be a whole different type of financial existence. Change the map, folks.
Change the map.
All right. I got to use the bathroom. Thank you all.
Well, thanks for letting us know that. Okay. and then you're going to go eat. You got to be hungry too. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for listening. I really did have fun. I enjoyed that.
Me
as
too.
Usual. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.